Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 49 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Let's Talk About Ag WeatherNet. You may not know it, but Washington State University's system of weather stations in eastern Washington is the first and most complete system of agricultural weather stations in the United States. And in just a couple of years, it will be celebrating its 30th anniversary. I believe that it's pretty much impossible to exhaust a farmer's interest in the weather, which is why I journeyed down to the WSU's Irrigated Agriculture Research and Extension Unit, located 5 miles northeast of Prosser. Buildings are located on a bucolic, tree-lined campus within a 191-acre site that hosts an array of irrigated crops. Nick Lloyd is the WSU meteorologist in charge of WSU's network of 177 weather stations throughout eastern Washington, with a smattering in northeast Oregon and a few in Idaho. Although the sites are predominantly located in irrigated regions, you'll hear Lloyd talk ahead of the scattering of stations throughout the dryland wheat region of the state, with the possibility of more being based there in the future. Ag WeatherNet has 11,000 registered users, but the numbers of people actually visiting the site is much higher, given that you can sign in as a guest. It opened for business in 1989 as what was known as PAWS, for Public Agriculture Weather System, and used radios to disperse weather information. Lloyd has been in charge of the weather network since 2011. A Yakima native, he attended MIT for his undergraduate degree. He received his master's degree in atmospheric sciences from Oregon State University. My experience of meteorologists is that most don't stumble into the profession. They're usually fascinated with the weather from a young age and decide to follow their passion. That's certainly true for Lloyd, so I found it ironic that his desk, with the two computer monitors on it, is in a windowless room. Just goes to show, the Ag WeatherNet system is about monitoring the weather, not looking at it. Although Lloyd and I have communicated by email and talked a couple of times over the phone, this was the first time we've met in person. He is a trim 32-year-old with a serene manner that's difficult to ruffle, ingredients that come in handy given his enjoyment of presentations about Ag WeatherNet and meteorology in general that he gives to audiences around the state. Speaking of which, for those lucky enough to have signed up, he'll be at the WSU Wheat Academy, which starts December 12th, talking about features and tools of Ag WeatherNet monitors that he believes would be valuable for those working in the wheat industry. I begin by asking Lloyd to describe the origins of Ag WeatherNet.
Back in the late 1980s, Washington State University and other interested parties had the idea of an automated weather network, and it was primarily the time for tree fruit and specifically with frost protection in mind. The idea of being able to monitor specific locations and evaluate in near real time what the temperature was like, or other weather parameters as well. And since then, of course, there are many changes and expansions of the network. Obviously now we're based on cell phone communications rather than radio telemetry as in the past, but the core principle of being committed to weather data and also decision support system for growers has remained the same.
But your crops have changed, haven't they?
That's right. Even though I think it's fair to say that at the inception of Ag WeatherNet is actually called PAWS, in 1989, for example, the old Public Agricultural Weather System, and gone through several permutations over time, now called Ag WeatherNet. Even though tree fruit was the initial goal, one of the things that's been exciting for me the last several years especially has been our expansion. One has been the expansion in space in terms of additional weather stations in the wheat country, parts of the dryland areas of eastern Washington. And another expansion has really just been more, in terms of our products and our mindset. We've really been engaging and coordinating and communicating with a variety of folks, growers, including wheat and grain growers and commissions. And so it's really been exciting for me that we're expanding our reach beyond tree fruit into the dryland areas as well.
So how many stations are there in Ag Weathernut at this point?
We have 177 automated state-of-the-art weather stations at this point. Again, they're located all across mainly Washington State. We do have a few in northern Oregon and one in Idaho as well, but predominantly in Washington State. And all of these, you know, automated weather stations, they're equipped not only with the sensors and the, you know, ability to collect the data, but we have data loggers to summarize it. We have cell phone modems to communicate that information back to our servers so that, you know, when that data is sensed at a given site, even hundreds of miles from our main headquarters here in Prosser, you'll see that in near real time every 15 minutes on our website. So, for example, at 10:01 a.m., you'll be able to see the 10 a.m. temperature and rainfall and things like that at any one of our stations.
What are the instruments that are included in a weather network site?
Ag WeatherNet stations have some of the standard weather parameters: air temperature, humidity, rainfall, wind speed and direction, and then also some sensors. You know, one of the advantages of Ag WeatherNet is we also have some less common features. We have leaf wetness, in some cases air pressure, solar radiation values, soil temperature at 8 inches of depth, and also 2 inches of depth in some cases.
Is the irrigated area well covered now? You don't need any more stations in the irrigated area?
The irrigated portions of central Washington are generally well covered. Certainly given the right set of circumstances, and it, you know, if there's really a need to fill another microclimate, we're always, you know, we welcome more stations, but certainly our focus, if we were going to expand, would be to some of the, I think, the still underserved areas, say the, you know, the wheat country, the dryland areas of eastern Washington, for example.
In the irrigated areas, of course, I understand the stone fruit, the apples, the grapes, all need precise weather data. But they can do something about it. I mean, they have windmills above the vineyards. They have smudge pots. But in the wheat country, there's really not much you can do. I'm curious about the rationale for installing weather stations in the dryland wheat country.
Even if it's not possible to, you know, alter your local weather conditions, it still, you know, can be very important and, you know, hopefully profitable to monitor the weather conditions, both in real time, looking at historical weather data when possible. You know, it's important to note that, for example, if there's some sort of a disease or pest that's going to be an issue, or just some sort of a cold snap or other environmental issue, even if it's not possible to avoid that issue occurring, it is still very important to understand. Let's say, for example, you know, there's been some sort of environmental, some sort of cold issue, and there's going to be damage to a crop, for example. If you can know that, the day it happens, and then make appropriate crop management decisions or even appropriate economic decisions, it's important to know that now and not, you know, many months later when it may show up and have a bigger or unforeseen impact.
So of those 177 stations that you have, how many could be used by dryland wheat agriculture?
Currently, you know, I think we have, you know, more than a handful, probably about 20 in that area. We certainly have several in the Pullman area and also scattered across other parts of eastern Washington near La Crosse, St. John, several near Spokane, Annatone in far southeastern Washington. But again, it would always be helpful to have, I think, both for the growers and for us, more weather stations. One thing that's always surprising to me is how even with in areas where we have large densities of weather stations, there are microclimates in Washington. We have varied topography. And it's always amazing to me how much the weather can vary over just a couple of miles. You wouldn't think that it would, but there can be significant differences in temperature and other factors over very short distance.
For those who might be listening who don't know about the three phases of El Niño, also known as ENSO, E-N-S-O, for El Niño Southern Oscillation, a quick primer is in order. The connection between El Niño and worldwide weather hasn't been known that long, really only since the early 1970s. Although El Niño includes a variety of other factors, for our purposes, it is a warm body of water off the coast of South America. La Niña is when that same water turns cool. Neutral is neither hot or cold. All three of these conditions provide different sorts of weather for parts of the world far from its equatorial source. Australia lives and dies by El Niño. So does the Southwest U.S. We in the Northwest are also affected by what phase of El Niño is occurring, with all three responsible for different sorts of weather conditions in the region. I asked Lloyd whether any one of these ocean conditions was superior to another in terms of the sort of weather eastern Washington might generally receive. He wouldn't be pinned down.
It will depend, on the specific crop. Each phase has, again, different expectations, even though there's significant variability within any type of winter, be it El Niño, La Niña winters, or neutral winters. Again, we tend to have warmer and sometimes drier winters with El Niño, sometimes cooler and wetter and harsher winters with La Niña. But really, it just depends. It's hard. There are advantages and disadvantages.
Well, let's talk about the next 4 months. Now, it appears what you're saying is that based on the La Niña, that it's going to be potentially a colder, harsher winter than it would be with El Niño or perhaps neutral. What are you looking for here during this winter?
Right now, it appears that the odds are slightly tilted, very slightly toward a harsher winter in terms of slightly cooler than normal, slightly wetter than normal, and possibly more snow than normal. However, again, there are always going to be conflicting factors. We discussed ENSO earlier, El Niño versus La Niña. That's something that happens in the tropical Pacific. It's a change of the patterns of sea surface temperatures and convection, whereby you have these areas of large thunderstorms which have a lot of rising air, a lot of water vapor released into the upper atmosphere, and that can impact our mid-latitude patterns because, as we know, in the mid-latitudes, we're in the battle zone between cold air from the north and warm air from the south, and as El Niño or La Niña impact the jet stream, and whether we're in an area where cold air is moving in from the north or warm air is moving in from the south, makes a significant difference in terms of our seasonal climate. And so during weak La Niñas, we tend to have a weaker low pressure area out in the Pacific Ocean. Now, typically, this area of low pressure steers generally warmer air in from the south, and it shunts the cold air that tries to build over northern Canada. It keeps it farther north and shunts it into the eastern U.S. Now, during La Niña, sometimes that low out in the Pacific is weaker, and so the cold air that sometimes builds over western Canada, for example, is more likely to make it into Washington State. So that's one thing that we look at, but there are other factors such as, again, long decadal trends, some of the long-range weather and short-term climate dynamical forecasts we can look at. And again, with trends being on the warmer side of things and with the dynamical models being fairly non-committal. So with the conflicting signals, I would say the odds for a harsh winter are still very weak, just slightly tilted in that direction at this point.
Now, in terms of climate change, are you willing to wade in and say that man is part of the cause of this?
Man certainly is one of many factors. So climate has changed in the past, even when man was not significant player in terms of the climate system. It will continue to change in the future. Again, man now is a part of that equation, but just one part.
Well, given the fact that 20,000 years ago, a lot of Washington was under a mile-deep glacier, should we really be concerned about changes in the climate at all?
I think there is reason for concern, and the reason for that is, I think regardless of the reason for the changing climate, you know, we become accustomed as a society to a certain climate, a certain set of conditions, what we consider normal, the typical ranges of variability, and then the extreme values. And as those sorts of things change over time, our society will be less well set up and adapted for those changes. So I think it's important at the very least to understand as much as we can about what has happened, what is happening, and will likely happen with the climate so that we can recognize that and make appropriate adaptations if necessary. It is likely that we have been warming and will continue to warm in the future. But on the other hand, I'm always very hesitant to look at very short periods of time and assign any one weather event or even a season or a year, be it unusually cold or warm, wet or dry, and assign that to a longer-term trend. I think then, even with longer-term changes happening and will likely to continue to happen, we'll have the variability as well. And I think it's important to recognize unusual weather events or even unusual weather seasons for what they are, as simply part of the natural variability of the climate system.
You know, I started in agriculture in 1986, and then in 1989 I had that big winter kill event, and it was big news. And then in 1991 there was another big winter kill event, and it was big news. There were lots of companies that went out of business during that time because it was just so difficult. Talk to me again about the fact that it's been almost 30 years since we have had a widespread winter kill event in eastern Washington. And we used to have winter kill events on average about every 7 years. It's just phenomenal that we haven't had one for so long.
We have been very lucky in general the last several decades in terms of a trend of decreasing severe cold outbreaks. And then of course, there are other features which are much more difficult to predict. Part of the concern with a winter kill would be strong winds associated with the cold temperatures or a lack of snow cover. And those are things that are, you know, somewhat random that aren't necessarily going to be dictated by, you know, longer-term trends. It's just, you know, something that either happens or it doesn't. But you know, we have been lucky generally over the last several decades. Again, when you look at the longer-term trends, especially since about the mid-1980s, it's been very uneven in terms of the temperature trends. When I talk about warming, most of the change that we see is in a lack of severe winter cold and not in other issues. For example, not necessarily in much warmer summers or in very warm winters becoming warmer. In the past, we often had huge ranges in the winter where occasionally you'd have a very warm winter and then a bitterly cold winter. What's predominantly happening in the modern era is that some of the other seasons are changing subtly. The very warmest of winters are not changing much, but the very coldest of winters are suddenly absent, such that we have very few cold winters and very severe cold events, even though, you know, some of the other seasons are not changing as significantly.
I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, you use the word luck. We've been very lucky. How does luck come into it?
Well, you know, one thing I've always said, even though there are long-term changes in the climate that are potentially predictable, unfortunately, in terms of predictability, anything beyond about 7 or 10 days is very difficult to predict in terms of day-to-day weather, because the nature of fluid dynamics and fluid physics, which is essentially what atmosphere and ocean circulations are, the nature of these fluid dynamics can be chaotic. They're very dependent upon your specific conditions at a time. And so, you know, oftentimes a specific weather event, even though You know, there may be some weather event that's more likely to happen in a given year. Even if you have, for example, a warmer than normal winter, there's no guarantee that there won't be at least a moderate cold outbreak. And even if you have a colder than normal winter, there's no guarantee there won't be a significant warm spell in there, because variability is always going to be something that's going to be part of the weather and climate system.
So back to the Ag WeatherNet system. And you were talking about the microclimates, and of course in the wheat industry we constantly talk about the microclimates. I mean, you can go to Lind where, you know, it's an average of 8 inches of moisture, and then to Pullman where it's an average of 22 inches of moisture. How many stations do you think it would take to cover wheat country in eastern Washington?
It would be helpful, ultimately, I think, for the growers if, you know, we could have a concentration that was at least similar to that of central Washington in the tree fruit areas. Now, again, that may not be possible for a variety of logistical and feasibility reasons, but, you know, I do think that in general, the more stations you have, the more data, the more you can really pick out those microclimates. But certainly, even at the present... the present configuration of stations, we are still able to get a representation of most of eastern Washington, and so we, you know, have been able to, you know, look at different issues with various stations near Pullman, Spokane, La Crosse, St. John, and things like that.
But you're saying if you had your druthers, you'd like another 100 stations out there at least.
That would be ideal, but we're living in the real world, so we'll take what we can get at this point.
It's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, and if the wheat industry wants more Ag WeatherNet stations in dryland wheat country, then asking the university for them is a good place to start. In an industry that depends on Mother Nature, it just makes sense to have the best reports on her moods. And given the hullabaloo over climate change, installing a more complete network and then analyzing the data seems to me a no-brainer. Washington State University was ahead of its time when it created the Public Agriculture Weather System. I hope they stay there as Ag WeatherNet proceeds into the future. That's all the time we have. I hope you've enjoyed episode 49 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Let's Talk About Ag WeatherNet. Join me again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We love the land. The farm's our career. But make no mistake, we do not steer. Mother Nature's in the driver's seat. I'm talking life, and I'm talking wheat. We're riding shotgun, and we have our say. But Mrs. N, she points the way. We feed you.